Hi, I'm Jillian Swinford.
And I'm Haley Brolison.
And this is Mother Nature Will Kill You,
a podcast about the most horrific tragedies
and the most triumphant survival stories that the wilderness can provide.
So grab your backpack
and maybe a bottle of wine.
And let's go on a wild ride into the unknown.
Walking down this road I go, but I am going alone. Running far, far from home, till I am but skin and bone. I don't wanna die, but I'll have to try. Oh, I don't wanna die, but I'm on my own. Good afternoon, good evening, good whenever you're listening to this little podcast.
It's been quite some time since Jillian and I got together over Zoom.
It has, because like we recorded two episodes back to back and then we saw each other literally a week later in Austin, which was a blast.
That was fun.
And then we haven't talked to each other for like literally weeks.
Yeah, besides like the text here and there.
Yeah, the odd text and the odd TikTok video.
Yeah, that's like my way of communicating with people, is sending them like videos or memes or something like that.
When it's like, it's almost like, then it's like, this is, I know this is your niche interest, so here you go, instead of like, hey, how are you? It's like,
yeah,
I don't know.
I was just looking back at our text to see like what like one of our random texts was, and like one of them was like an old picture of us working at Vim's.
Yes.
And then the other one was like about episode titles, and then the other one was me watching Bluey, because I was like, I know you like this, let me see what it's all about.
What do you think about Bluey?
I like it, honestly. Like I was really looking forward to telling you my opinion on it. Okay. Because I was watching it and I was like, wow, this is like healing a part of my inner child that I did not even know needed healing.
Yes.
It just is like very comforting. Like it feels like I'm in the nurse's office at elementary school. Yes. Like it just is like that like safe healing feeling. And I was like, oh wow, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm feeling a lot of things right now.
So it makes sense now why Corey and I will, like, late at night, we'll watch a couple of episodes to settle down and just be like, all right, cool.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about it. I don't know if it's, like, the tone and how they talk or, like, the decibel level. Like, I don't know what it is, but something about it just sounds very healing. And it's just, like, really cute how, like, there's only a couple episodes on Hulu, and so I can't watch, like, all of them,
know?
And so there was one episode that I watched, and he like, Blue was scared to cross the river, or maybe it was like, what's the other one's name? Like the sister's name? Bingo. Yeah, maybe it was Bingo. I don't know. But one of them was scared to cross the river, and they're like, come on, you can do it. And like, they like believed in themselves and crossed the river, and it was like super cute. And I was like, oh, nice.
And also, they have like very real, like, talk about what it's like to be a parent and an adult, and like, you know, raising these kids when, you know, you're frustrated with them, or like, you know, you're trying to get something done and the kids want to do something else, and it's like, I don't know, it's cathartic to me.
Yeah, no, it's nice, it's a good show. I put it on one day and like Alex is getting ready for work, and I like looked over and I was like, just so you know, I'm watching this because Jillian told me it's good. So
I'm watching this for educational purposes only.
Yeah, I was like, I don't want you thinking I'm like a child over here, but like also I heard it was good, so I want to like, see.
It is, and that's funny that you say that it's like healing your inner child, because that's, I think, exactly why so many childless adults watch this show.
Yeah, you're like, I just need something nice right now.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, it's become our new like comfort show, and you know, we have Disney Plus, so we have it all.
Oh, okay. We have Disney Plus too. I didn't realize it was on Disney Plus. I guess
Yeah,
I could have like Googled that.
all
Okay.
of it is on
Then
Disney
that's cool.
Plus.
Well, that's what I'm gonna be watching today while I clean the house.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
There are like episodes of that show that make me straight up cry every
Oh,
single
I'm
time.
sure.
And it's so
Yeah.
good.
There
So.
was one episode I watched and it was like Bingo was like having a bad day because she felt like everybody was taking things from her. And
Yeah.
the mom was like, "Do you feel like you're not being heard and people keep taking things from you and like, you know, this and that?" And she had this like toy that said yes or no. And so then she would say the
The
yes, yeah, that episode, the yes, no button. And so, yeah, no, that was like, that was cute. And then the dad was like, "How can we make it up to you? Like, we're sorry. Like, we didn't mean to do that. Like, how can we make it up to you?" Like, and then Bluey's like, "I don't know. Like, let's go get ice cream." And it's like, then they all go get ice cream and like, you know, everything's better. And it's like, oh, that's nice. Like you noticed your child was having a moment.
no button.
You put two and two together because you're mindful and observant. And then you communicated and apologized and repaired. And everything's better again.
And you re
Because
you recognize that you made a mistake, and because you're human or dog in this case.
Yes.
So Corey has decided that I am Chili. I am like the mom. That is going to be me as a mother,
Oh.
100%. But Bingo, the little one, is my absolute favorite. Like if I have a child that's like Bingo, I would be so happy.
Yeah. That's cute. They are cute.
It's kind of funny because we are doing an episode about dogs
Dogs.
today.
Yeah, we are. We can get into it if you want to. Just skip on through.
Yeah, I mean, because we know what we did in Austin.
Yeah, we do. So it's fun. We went and saw the bats.
Yes, they didn't come out en masse like they were supposed to, but it was still fun.
Yeah, it was
Still
fun. And I
fun.
will say, but for the listeners, because I know Jillian knows this already, but like, if anybody recalls when I had bats in my attic, I literally thought Jillian was joking when she asked me if I wanted to go see bats. And I was like, girl, I just had bats in the attic. Like, I've been seeing bats. I know what they are, you know? But I didn't realize that this one bridge in Austin is like literally riddled with bats. And it's like a whole spectacle at night when they come out in like thousands, hundreds of thousands. But they never came out in hundreds of thousands for us. They just came out like little by little. But it was still pretty cool to like, you know, learn about the environmental history of the bats there and like how the engineering of the bridge pretty much like creates the perfect habitat for them. And they all just kind of congregate and reproduce and eat all the bugs around there. So,
No,
even though
it was a nice little trip considering it's so fucking hot.
yeah, it was fucking hot. Oh, and we went to this spring that's a pool where there's salamanders in there, but we didn't see any salamanders.
Didn't see any
Yeah,
salamanders
but that
or
was
too many
fun.
people
Yeah,
because it
it's
was
like,
hot.
yeah, and it's not even like when you think of a pool, it's not like the, I don't know, the true tile pool bottom or concrete pool bottom that you probably think about. It's like literal a spring. So there's like rocks and dirt and algae like that. It's like a natural bottom. And then they just open it up to the public to swim in. So
They put like a concrete rectangle around it, and like that's
yeah.
why it's a pool. But like the deepest part is like 20 feet deep. Like I
Yeah.
tried to get to the bottom, I could not.
But she saw some fishes, and
I
me,
did.
I just floated around. I did not swim too much because I was nervous about my asthma and it being way too hot out, and I didn't want to have an episode. So
No, it
I
was
just
fun.
floated.
And we
Yeah, it
went
was
to
good.
bars and we sweated a ton. And you
Yeah,
went to a wedding.
I did. That was fun. They had beer donkeys at that wedding.
I know.
I was like, this is cool, but also like part of me is like, oh, is this animal abuse? Like,
I mean, if they're gonna be outside anyway, it's
yeah, and
just,
like
you
they
know.
are pack animals, like they are used for that purpose, like to pack things. But still, I felt kind of bad being like, oh, look at this donkey, because it looked kind of miserable. But
Corey
it
was
was a cool
jealous.
idea. Yeah, no, it
Corey
was
was
definitely a cool idea.
jealous because he loves donkeys.
Oh, yeah, they weren't out for very long, honestly. I think they were only out for like cocktail hour, so like an hour. They like walked them around for a bit
So they're
or
probably
something.
fine.
Yeah, they're probably fine. It just,
They're
but still,
donkeys.
that's like the first thought that goes through my brain when I see animals out. I'm like, oh, I hope they're okay. Like the horses in Charleston, like that's I've heard that that's animal abuse for them because they're like being worked like all
Yeah.
day out and
Yeah.
like not treated well. So,
I think it
yeah.
depends on the practices and what they're being used for. And it's also really funny that you bring this up because we're about to talk about fucking sled dogs.
I know it's true. But it seems like sled dogs, I didn't do a lot of research into that, but it seems like that's like what they're bred for. Like
Oh,
they're that's like their species, or not species, but whatever, you know what I mean? Like
yeah, like husky, their breed.
husky, yeah, the breed, yeah.
Waylon is just rolling around back. He is
Oh,
living
is
his
he?
best life. Just
I
watching him, like,
didn't even see that. That's funny.
oh,
Look at
Waylon,
him. He's on
he
his back doing
just
the back
ripped.
scratches. Look, there's
Oh,
Julian,
puppy
bud.
boy.
He's got like the Dumbo ear up, like,
No.
hey, Bubba. Yeah, we did our engagement photo shoot yesterday and got
Ooh.
him out there and did some pictures with him. And I'm hoping that he's still pretty exhausted from that. Yeah,
Yeah.
it was hot. It's hot out. And we were at Bahia Honda yesterday, which dogs aren't allowed on the beach, but the photographer was like, let's bring him on the beach. And we're like, okay, we'll see
Yeah.
what happens. Hopefully we don't get yelled at, and we didn't. But also part of me is like, oh, like now I don't know if I can ever post those pictures because people are like, you can't have dogs on the beach, you know?
Those
But
people love to point out your mistakes on the internet. It's
I
their
know.
favorite thing.
Well, and it's like, well, for me and Alex, like we do know better than doing that, you know? So like it's one of those things where like we broke the rules and we were like really like, I don't know, hesitant, but also like I kind of grateful that it worked out. But yeah.
Yeah.
So we brought Waylon in for some pictures for like the family picture stuff, and like some of the samples I saw on her camera when she was like going through, like they look super cute. And I'm excited to see them. And I think it's gonna take like a month to get like all of them back, but I should get like some sneak peeks back today or tomorrow, which is good because I need to send the save the dates out like pretty much ASAP
Yeah, is that
because
what you needed my address yesterday?
yes, that. Yes. I'm like starting to gather addresses and I am like, I need addresses for people. So yeah.
Yeah. No, I did that whole thing too. I'm like, I'm not trying to be obvious about this or anything, but give me your address.
Yeah, like how else do I get that these days? You know, it's like I just have to straight
No.
up ask. Like there's no
No.
yellow pages. Well, there probably is, but
Even if there is, it's not like you can get a Yellow Pages for every single place that people live in.
I know.
No, we're also spread out now.
I know. So yeah. So yeah. So we've been starting to talk through some things, and after mini season, we'll go down to the property and walk around it. Because you know, mini season is this weekend or coming up at least. And that's for those listening, it's lobster mini season, spiny lobster mini season down here. It's a shit show of a time. I would highly recommend not being on the water unless you have to. But yeah, so it's a time where people come down early a few days before spiny lobster season opens officially, and they get like the first, you know, dibs on lobster. And it opened up, I forget how long ago, but it was like years ago they started doing it. I want to say it was like the 70s or the 80s, maybe they started doing it.
Yeah.
And I could be very wrong on that because my memory's been failing me recently. But they opened it up for the purpose, I believe, to like improve tourism. So it was like, oh, if we give them like a couple extra days for the season before it opens full time, like it'll bring more tourism down, you know, a little boost. Which is dumb to me because spiny lobster season is pretty much open 8 months of the year. So I'm like, why do you need to have a mini season when it's open for
Yeah.
most of the year, you
Yeah.
know? So I don't know, but it's like, it's the locals down here know it as like a rape and pillage weekend.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's not good. And then the water temps down here are fucking hot.
Yeah.
Like all of the coral is bleaching.
Oh no.
I heard through some people that like 100% of coral tissue at Sombrero Reef is dead,
Yeah.
and it's not gonna get any better. Like
No.
to cool the water temperatures down, you need a storm, and there's no storm coming this way
No, I
anytime
know.
soon.
I know.
And
We're it's ridiculous out here too. I think it's like kind of record temperatures all over, because when we were
everywhere.
driving up to Arkansas this past weekend, it was like We were getting like excessive heat warnings literally everywhere, like in Oklahoma and Arkansas. Thankfully, when we were in Arkansas, like the weather was, to us, was very nice.
Yeah.
So we'd been dealing with crazy heat. But it just, and my mom was like, oh yeah, it's been like god awful up here. And I'm just
Yeah.
like, holy cow.
You know, it's bad. It's bad everywhere. Like, and it seems like from what I've watched on the news, it seems like there's like this heat cell that's like moving east from the west. And it's just like taking its sweet ass time moving through. And so it's just starting to like impact all these places. And it's hot out. Like, it's no joke. Like, when we were in Texas, my parents were trying to find this restaurant and we're walking around the Riverwalk in San Antonio. And like, they start getting frustrated with each other because like one thinks that they know better than the other kind of thing. And I'm like, I'm not here for this. It's way too fucking hot out. We cannot be bullshitting around. Like, we need to like have a plan and like go do the plan, you know?
Yeah.
But it's true though. It's hot out there and it's like you can't be like fucking around outside not knowing what you're doing and like then you get
No.
lost and then like you don't have water with you and it's like people get dehydrated and then like heat stroke and I don't know, heat exhaustion. It's just not a fun time.
No,
So.
it's definitely hitting like dangerous levels. Like I got heat exhaustion a couple of weeks ago, just
Out
from
working.
being up, like doing field work. So,
Yeah.
and I was
Yeah.
drinking water all day long, and you just cannot keep up because you sweat so much.
Yeah.
It's
I
awful.
really, but anyway,
So,
yeah, it's fucking hot out.
let's take a dip into the imaginary cold.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Let's
Ooh.
because we talked about Death Valley last time, because I was like,
Which,
it's hot. So
yeah, it is
I
fucking
was gonna
hot.
talk about somewhere hot, but now I'm like, no, let's go back to the Arctic. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah, so today we're going to be in Alaska, everybody. So we're going to tell a story about how a dog saved an Alaskan town. And no, I am not talking about Balto because I am talking about Togo. And I will
Yes.
s die on this hill of
Yes.
preaching about Togo. I am not ashamed to say it. He's the real hero. So in 1925, diphtheria swept through the small town of Nome, Alaska. And diphtheria is an infection that usually affects the mucous membranes of the throat and nose, which can lead to difficulty breathing, heart rhythm problems, and death. This infection is
Good.
easily prevented by a vaccine. Yeah, real nice. It's easily preventable by a vaccine. But there was like one problem was that they didn't have enough vaccines around. So Togo's mission was to get a vaccine to Nome. And this was also more than just Togo's mission, that this was multiple dogs' mission. We'll
Yeah,
get
I
into it.
know. I've seen the animated movie Balto, so I know all about
Well, since you got Disney Plus, go look up Togo on Disney Plus because it's the movie's on there and it
Oh,
makes
I
me
didn't
cry
know.
every time.
I
Yeah.
didn't know he had a movie,
Yeah,
too.
I know. You should go watch it after we talk about this.
Wait, is it also animated?
No, it's not. It's like human and real dogs and
Oh,
stuff.
okay.
Yeah, it makes me cry every time. But
Okay.
a lot of things have been making me cry recently, so like
Right.
for
So go watch
the
Bluey and then you'll cry
yeah.
some more.
Yeah. So Nome is located 2 degrees south of the Arctic Circle and was home to 455 Alaskan natives and 975 European settlers at the time. As of 2021, the population count was around 3,594 people. Between November and July, the port into Nome on the southern shore of the Seward Peninsula in the Bering Sea was icebound and inaccessible by steamship. During this time, the only link to the rest of the world was the gosh, I always say that wrong. Iditarod.
Iditarod.
Yeah, I always get the T's. Yeah, Iditarod Trail. I know, I always do that even without talking about this. I'm like, the Iditarod?
It's like me in
Iditarod.
Yosemite.
Yeah,
Or what
Yosemite.
did I say? Yeah. What is it actually? It's Yosemite, right?
Yeah, that's what I think it
And
is.
I
I don't
said
know.
Yosemite or
Maybe.
something
Yeah.
like that.
Yeah. So the only link to the rest of the world was the Iditarod. God damn it. Say it one more time.
I did a rod.
I did a rod. I did a
I
rod. I did
did
a
a
rod. I
rod.
did a rod. Okay. Okay, was the Iditarod Trail, which runs 938 miles from the port of Seward to Nome. And honestly, I've been to Seward and it's a very pretty place, and I highly recommend stopping there if you ever are in Alaska.
I want to go to Alaska so bad, but I just It just hasn't. There have
I
been
know.
priorities, and Alaska, unfortunately, has been on the bottom,
I
you
know.
know.
That well, that's how I felt too. And then my friend Sarah hit me up like 2 years ago and she's like, "Hey, I want to go to Alaska for my birthday. You want to come?" I was like, "Fuck yeah, I want to go. I've always wanted to go there." I was like, "I've just
Yeah.
never had the opportunity or like the reason, you know,
Yeah.
other than and I also don't know my way around Alaska." And we were going with one of her friends who works summers in Denali. So like
Oh,
he
yeah.
knows, you know. Well, I'm
Yeah.
like, that's a good setup. So yeah,
I'm
no,
trying
that
to
was a
get Ethan to get stationed there so that we can go.
yeah. No, my parents' neighbors, they actually were in the Coast Guard and was stationed there. And they were telling me about their experience there the other day because they're like, "Oh yeah, we were stationed in Alaska and like, you know, we were like really miserable about it. We thought it was going to suck." And then we get there and it's just like, you know, it opens up into the harbor and you have all these mountains around you and it's just like the most beautiful thing. And like they really enjoyed their time there to the point where they have like a second home there and they're trying to get my parents to come visit them. And I was like, "Can I come? Like, when do you guys go? Can I come?"
I crash the party?
Yeah. There are neighbors. I'm like, yeah, why not?
Why not?
They're over at our house all the time.
It counts.
Anyways. So several months before the winter of 1924 to 1925, because we're talking about like a December to January, February time frame. So like we're
Okay.
transitioning years. Curtis Welch, the only doctor in Nome, ordered more diphtheria antitoxin. And he had discovered that the batch of the 25-bed Maynard Columbus Hospital had expired. So there's this antitoxin that helps with the diphtheria illness, and the ones that they did have around, unfortunately, had expired. And unfortunately, the shipment would not arrive to the port because it's closed for the winter. Within days of the last ship leaving the port, Dr. Welch treated a few children for what he first diagnosed as tonsillitis. Over the next few weeks, the cases of tonsillitis grew and four children died. I know, like,
Shit.
it's bad. Dr. Welch continued, he, excuse me. Dr. Welch began to get concerned about the possibility of diphtheria. So at this point, he just thinks it's tonsillitis. By mid-January, Dr. Welch made the first official diagnosis of diphtheria in a 3-year-old boy. The child later died 2 weeks after displaying the first symptoms. So it's
That's
pretty quick.
rough.
Yeah.
That's rough.
The next day, a 7-year-old girl died. And so he realized that an epidemic was imminent, and he called Mayor George Maynard to arrange an emergency meeting. A quarantine was immediately implemented, but despite this, there were over 20 confirmed cases of diphtheria and at least 50 more at risk by the end of the month. Without antitoxin, they believed that the mortality rate could be close to 100%.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, and Nome is like up there. Like it's isolated.
Yes, it's very
It's
isolated.
almost at the Arctic Circle, almost.
What'd I say? 2 miles south? 2 degrees south
Yeah.
of the Arctic Circle.
Yeah. And like back then in the 20s,
Yeah, not yeah, not
like
good. So
but
since no plane or ship could reach the isolated town, a unanimous decision was made to use multiple dog sled teams to transport the medicine across the dangerous land. Thus, the serum run was made. In 1925, the serum run to Nome, also known as the Great Race of Mercy and also the serum run, was a transport of diphtheria antitoxin by dog sled relay across the U.S. territory of Alaska by 20 mushers and about 150 sled dogs across 674 miles in 5.5 days, which would then in turn save the small town of Nome and the surrounding communities from a developing epidemic of diphtheria.
I mean,
And
imagine if they hadn't done this, like all like a whole generation of children and
gone.
possibly adults would be dead. Yeah.
Yes, I know. It's so like that's why I mean the hairs on my arms are standing up, and that's why every time I watch Togo, I just like get moved to tears because I'm like, holy crap, like this was real life. Like
Yeah.
people were sick, and then there was like they found a way to save a whole town, and it's like out of the goodness of all of these mushers' hearts. Like they didn't have to do it, but they felt responsible. They're like, "I'm willing and able, like we need to save this town and we're gonna do it." And it's just like
Yeah.
I guess like the community around it is like what makes like my heart happy is like everybody like came together to like help this one town.
Yeah, very
So
different than the COVID epidemic
yeah.
or pandemic. Wasn't an
Yeah.
epidemic, it's pandemic.
And
Very
so
different vibe.
yeah, very, very different vibe. So I'm sure we've already mentioned Balto. So Balto often gets the credit for saving the town of Nome, but it was really Togo, a Siberian husky, who led this team across the most dangerous leg of the journey and saved the town of Nome. So we're going to get into the Serum Run as a whole.
Quick. So is Balto the most famous because he did the last leg of the.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. He and like that's what it says in the Togo movie too, is like. So, I mean, we're going to get into it, but I have really strong feelings about this. No, he's famous because he was the dog that crossed the quote unquote finish line.
Yeah.
But like, and so therefore, like all of the news reporters were standing there waiting for this moment to happen. And so he was the one that was there, but Togo was the one that literally did the most. And like, as a dog, is like the most amazing dog. And so we're going to get into all of
Okay.
that.
Okay.
So at the January 24th meeting of the Board of Health, Superintendent Mark Summers of the Hammond Consolidated Gold Fields proposed a dog sled relay using two fast teams. One would start at Nenana, Alaska, the closest railhead of the Alaska Railroad, and the other at Nome, and they would meet roughly halfway in the town of New Alto. The trip from New Alto to Nome normally took 30 days. Curtis Welch estimated that the serum would last only 6 days under brutal conditions on the trail. So
Ooh.
Summers, and yeah, not a good time. Summers' employee, the Norwegian sled dog trainer and musher, Leonard Seppala, was chosen for the 630-mile round trip from Nome to New Alto and back. He had previously made the run in a record-breaking 4 days, won the All-Alaska Sweepstakes 3 times, and had become famous for his athletic ability and rapport with his Siberian huskies. So this guy, Leonard Seppala, is like top-notch musher, and he's got top-notch dogs. Maynard proposed flying the antitoxin by plane, but in 1925, planes were a relatively new technology, and Alaska's harsh winter weather made them unreliable.
Yeah.
Several test flights had been conducted the previous year routine for bleh, I cannot talk today. Several test flights had been conducted the previous year between Fairbanks. God damn it. I'm gonna try this one more time. I think
The
I know. I'm like, is my brain okay? I woke up and my jaw has been hurting, and I'm like, I can't tell if I have a cavity or if something's like severely wrong with my head right
Are you
now.
smelling toast or smelling burnt toast? You might be having a
No.
stroke.
No. Oh my God. That's why I'm like, am I okay? Like, I think I'm just having a moment. Several test flights had been conducted the previous year between Fairbanks and McGrath, Alaska, to determine how well a reliable aircraft could handle the winter conditions. The longest test flight flew a distance of only 260 miles, a little under the half necessary distance between Nenana and Nome. Furthermore, the only planes operating in Alaska in 1925 were three vintage biplanes, which had been dismantled for the winter. Their open cockpits and water-cooled engines would make these planes unfit for the trip as well. Although it was potentially quicker, the proposal to deliver the antitoxin by flight was rejected by the Board of Health. Instead, they voted unanimously for the dog sled relay. Seppala was notified that evening and immediately began preparations for the trip.
Could you
So,
imagine flying in an open cockpit in the
God.
Alaskan winter?
No, thank you. No, thank you. I would not want that at all.
When they were like, oh, I don't think flying's gonna work. I'm like, oh, yeah, because you probably still have biplanes that are like c canvas and wood or whatever. Like,
Yeah.
fuck.
I know. And like in that weather too, like it's fucking cold out. Like we'll get into how cold it was. So, the US Public Health Service had located 1.1 million units of serum in West Coast hospitals, which could be shipped to Seattle, Washington, and then transported to Alaska. The next ship north would not arrive in Seattle until January 31st, and it would take another 6 to 7 days to arrive in Seward. On January 26, however, 300,000 forgotten units of the antitoxin were located in a hospital in Anchorage, and the supply was wrapped in glass vials and then padded with quilts and finally a metallic cylinder weighing a little over 20 pounds. At Governor Scott Bone's order, it was immediately shipped to Nenana and arrived the next day. While not sufficient to defeat the epidemic at 3,000 units, or 300,000 units, could slow the spread of the disease until the larger shipment arrived. So it's kind of like a band-aid.
How
To
does that
until like,
work? Because there's like only a little over 3,000 people in town. Like, do I have to do multiple vaccines or?
I don't know about that. I was under the impression it was just like one vaccine they would have to do because it goes into, I do some math later. I write some math down later.
Some math.
Yeah,
Don't
no,
worry.
we'll get into that. We'll
Okay.
we'll come back to that question. But I had to do some math, so we'll see how
Okay.
accurate that was.
All
We
right.
know me and math, it's not great. Okay. The temperatures across the Alaskan territory were at a 20-year lows due to a high pressure system from the Arctic. In Fairbanks, the temperature was negative 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Fuck
So
that.
it's perfect. It's perfect
So
conditions.
so cold. Winds reaching the speeds of 25 miles an hour caused snow to cover the Alaskan panhandle and snowdrifts up to 10 feet tall.
Good.
It's like it's
Great.
not an ideal situation going on over there. Travel by sea was hazardous, and across the interior, most forms of the transportation shut down. Furthermore, there were limited hours of daylight to fly due to the polar night. So, to pause and recap, we have 300,000 units of antitoxin in Nenana, and we have our dog sled teams. So now we're going to get into the relay.
All right.
The first musher in this relay was Wild Bill Shannon, who was handed the 20-pound package at the train station in Nenana on January 27th at 9 p.m. Despite a temperature of negative 50 degrees Fahrenheit, Shannon left immediately with his team of nine inexperienced dogs led by Blackie. So that's like the lead dog is named Blackie. The temperature began to drop, and the team was forced onto the colder ice of the river because the trail had been destroyed by horses. Despite jogging alongside the sled to keep warm, Shannon developed hypothermia. He reached Minto at 3 a.m. with parts of his face black from frostbite. The
Ooh.
temperature was negative 62 degrees Fahrenheit after, which was, what is that, 12 degrees cooler than when he left. After warming the serum by the fire and resting for 4 hours, Shannon dropped the three dogs and left for Tolovana with the remaining eight dogs. The three dogs died shortly after Shannon returned to Minto for them, and a fourth may have died as well.
So did he drop the dogs because they weren't doing well, or?
I think he dropped them because he like saw that they were exhausted, yeah, and just wanted them to rest and try to save them. And so on this map here, like you can see Fairbanks right above Nenana, and then Minto is like just to the left, and then Tolovana is like right to the left of that. So it was just like a little shoop shoop back and forth.
Okay. So yeah, so they got the serum up there by railroad from Seward. Okay.
Yeah, that dotted line it goes,
Okay.
which was like a pretty much like half, maybe a little bit less than half of the distance that they traveled was like rail. So I mean, at least like the rail was there, right? So then after Shannon drops it off in Tolovana, half Athabaskan, which is a native Alaskan, like Native American Alaskan. I'm gonna lisp that every time. Half Athabaskan. That's hard. Edgard Calland arrived in Minto the night before, and then he was sent back to Tolovana, traveling 70 miles the day before the relay. So it's like, it seems like they kind of like cross paths a little bit. Like I was reading this and I was a little confused because Shannon comes into Minto and then like leaves to go to Tolovana. And then like this guy, Edgar Calland, like arrived in Minto, but they're like, oh no, you should go back because he's already going that way, you know? So it seems like there was kind of like a crosshair of communication there. So Shannon and his team arrived in Tolovana in bad conditions at 11 a.m. and handed over the serum to Edgar Calland. After warming the serum in the roadhouse, Calland headed into the forest. The temperature had fallen to negative 56 degrees Fahrenheit, causing Calland's hands to freeze to the sled's handlebar, requiring the owner of the Manly Hot Springs Roadhouse to pour boiling water on the birchwood bar for thawing.
Good.
And so, just to recap, there are a couple of teams that are going in quite literally like blizzard conditions to try to move the serum across to Nome, and like where they're stopping, these roadhouses are essentially like these like safe havens. So like it's a small home with a bed, a fireplace, like blankets, food, whatever. And those are like their safe havens as they're trekking across Alaska. So if you hear
so,
the word roadhouse, it's like a safe haven.
It's what. Just making me think of the Family Guy episode where Peter Griffin, I can't remember why he keeps saying roadhouse, but he'll like, he's like, roadhouse.
It's because of that movie.
It's
didn't he like
movie,
watch that movie? Yeah.
I don't remember how like that started, but like the whole episode, he keeps like punching people or like,
he's like roadhouse.
People, and he's like, roadhouse.
That's funny. I was just watching Family Guy before we hopped on. I'll have to go find that episode. So, okay. 2 days after the race began, two new cases were diagnosed on January 29th. So the team started on the 27th and there was no cases diagnosed on the 28th, but on the 29th, there had been two new cases diagnosed.
Okay.
The quarantine had been obeyed, but lack of diagnostic tools and the contagiousness of the stain, or not the stain, the contagiousness of the strain rendered it ineffective. More units of serum were discovered around Juneau the same day. And while no count exists, it's estimated based on the weight that roughly 125,000 units, which would be enough to treat 4 to 6 patients, is what that was. So again, recap, there are 300,000 units of antitoxin headed to Nome. So that's like, this is when I did the math. So I want to say I divided this by 6 because it was like, if 125,000 units can treat 4 to 6 patients, I'm like, okay, so then like divided by 6, higher number. I guess what, 20,833.33 units per person. So like 300 units would be enough to treat like 14 to 15 people. I don't know. I don't know if I mapped that right. But
I love when you add hashtag math.
Yeah, I knew you would know what that meant.
I mean, it's definitely not enough to treat like definitely
a whole town.
Under 20 people. Okay. So I was thinking like units were like the actual, like each like unit of vaccine. I forgot that they measure, that's like the measurement. So it's like how much is in each vial of, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, again, like this run, the serum run is essentially a band-aid until like the million of units can get to, to Alaska. And so, I mean, what, there was already, like, what they say earlier, like, four, like, two kids died, and then there's, like, two more cases that were diagnosed. So, like, you know, treating 14 to 15 people with that much is, I don't know. It seems like it'd be enough to kind of, like, make a difference, which is, you know.
Yeah.
Even if it was one person, that would, you know, be good enough. So,
I mean,
more
if
of
you
a
could
band-aid.
Keep those kids in quarantine, then potentially you could stop that spread. But
So essentially it's like a band-aid until the millions of units come.
Yeah.
And they figure out like a better plan, obviously. So the crisis had become headline news in newspapers, including San Francisco, Cleveland, Washington, D.C., and New York, and spread to the radio sets, which were just becoming common. The storm system in Alaska hit the continuous United States, bringing record lows to New York and freezing the Hudson River. A fifth death occurred on January 30th, and I believe that is a person and not a dog. Maynard and Alaskan House Delegate Daniel Sutherland renewed their campaign for flying the remaining serum by plane. Different proposals included flying a large aircraft 2,000 miles from Seattle to Nome, carrying a plane to the edge of the pack ice via Navy ship and launching it, and then also the original plan of flying the serum from Fairbanks. Despite receiving headline coverage across the country and support from Arctic explorer Roald Amundsen, which you have talked about him before.
I was going to say, you remember him?
Yeah, I was like, that name rings a bell.
Yes.
The plans were rejected by experienced pilots, the Navy, and Governor Bone. As publisher and editor of the Fairbanks Daily News minor newspaper, William Fentress Thompson harshly criticized the government officials for inaction and funded a private fleet of planes. In response, Governor Bone decided to speed up the relay, authorizing additional drivers for Sepala's leg of the relay so they could travel without rest. Sepala was still scheduled to cover the most dangerous leg, the shortcut across Norton Sound, but the telephone and telegraph systems bypassed the small villages he was passing through, and there was no way to tell him to wait at Shaklatuk.
Yeah.
So, in his mind, he's still going where he's supposed to be going.
Yeah.
But everybody else is trying to like formulate a different plan and he needs to wait, but he doesn't know. So the plan relied on the driver from the north catching Sepala on the trail. So like in the movie, like it's like blizzard conditions and like they nearly miss each other type of thing. Summers arranged for drivers along the last leg, including Sepala's colleague Gunnar Kassen, which Gunnar Kassen is the musher of Balto. Side
Okay.
note. From Manly Hot Springs, the serum passed through largely Athabascan hands before George Nolliner delivered it to Charlie Evans at Bishop Mountain on January 30th at 3 a.m. The temperature had warmed slightly, but at -2 degrees Fahrenheit was dropping again. It just makes me laugh, like reading those temperatures. And be like, oh, it
I
warmed
know.
slightly.
Meanwhile, we're getting freaking like heat indexes of like 102 over here.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know what that's like.
Evans relied on his lead dogs when he passed through the ice fog where the Koyukuk River, flowing into the Yukon, had broken through and surged over the ice, but forgot to protect the groins of his two short-haired mixed-breed lead dogs with rabbit skins. Both his dogs collapsed with frostbite, with
Oh.
Evans having to take their place himself pulling the sled. He arrived at 10 a.m. Both dogs were dead. Tommy Patsy departed within half an hour. So now we're continuing on. It's like they keep passing this through. And honestly,
Yeah.
like poor dogs, like they're going through so much. And like also the mushers, like they're getting frostbite. The dogs are dying of frostbite. Like it's a horrible conditions that they're putting themselves through, but they're doing it because they're trying to save the town. Like that's
Well,
why I'm like, oh my
yeah.
God, this is insane.
Frostbite of the groin, too. That's a rough
Yeah.
way to go. I
I
didn't even
know
think
those poor
about that because
dogs.
that's like the one part of a dog that's not covered in hair.
Yeah. Those poor doggies.
I know.
So the transport of the serum then parted ways with the Yukon River as the river turned south and the trail crossed the Kaltag Portage west to the coast. Athabascan Jack Nikolai, aka Jack Screw, took it up the first half of the portage to Old Woman Cabin, and Victor Enegik of the Inupiat Village. I was trying to enunciate this earlier.
You've been doing so good.
Unalakleet. 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 Yeah, okay. Having driven up to meet him there, took it down the second half, handing it to his fellow villager, Miles Gunnigan. Gunnigan? God, Gunnigan. Gunnigan. Miles Gunnigan on the
That's
shores.
a white person name too. That's
I was like, there's too many N's and G's in that name. Like, To his fellow villager Miles Gunnigan on the shores of Norton Sound in Unalakleet on January 31st at 5 a.m. Gunnigan saw the signs of a storm brewing and decided not to take the shortcut across the dangerous ice of the sound. He departed at 5:30 in the morning, and as he crossed the hills, quote, "The eddies of drifting, swirling snow passing between the dogs' legs and under the bellies made them appear to be fording a fast-running river. The
Jeez.
whiteout conditions cleared as he reached the shore, and the gale-force winds drove the wind chill to -70 degrees Fahrenheit." So fucking cold. At 3 p.m., he arrived at Shaklutuk, and Sepala was not there, but Henry Ivanov was waiting just in case. On January 30th, the number of cases in Nome had reached 27 and the antitoxin was depleted. According to a reporter living in Nome, quote, "All hope is in the dogs and their heroic drivers. Nome appears to be a deserted city," end quote. With the report of Gonnigan's progress on January 31st, Welch believed the serum would arrive there in February. Leonard Sepala and his dog sled team with his lead dog Togo traveled 91 miles from Nome from January 27th to January 31st into the oncoming storm. They took the shortcut across the Norton Sound and headed towards Shaklutuk. The temperature in Nome was a relatively warm -20 degrees Fahrenheit, but in Shaklutuk, the temperature was estimated at -30 degrees Fahrenheit, and the gale force winds causing a wind chill of -85 degrees Fahrenheit. Jesus Christ. That is insanely cold.
Relatively warm, -20. It's balmy.
I
It's
know,
just
right?
balmy.
Well, after being a -85 degrees, I'm sure -20 would feel great. Oh my God. Henry Ivanov's team ran into a reindeer and got tangled up just outside of Shaklatuk. Sebla still believed he had more than 100 miles to the original relay point in New Alto to go and had raced to get off the Norton Sound before the storm hit. He was passing the team when Ivanov shouted, "The serum! The serum! I have it here!" So that's the part in the movie where they're like passing each other because the weather's so bad.
So
Sebla
they
turned
literally
around.
could have missed each other.
Yes, yeah. Like they, yeah, they really could have missed each other.
Also, I love how Ivanov, like, their team ran into a reindeer. Does that mean they, like, fucking hit a reindeer, like, roadkill style with the dogs?
I know, it kind of seems like it, honestly. Like they got tangled up, like, geez.
Like, that's a
Probably.
thing that can happen.
Yeah. Sepala turned around with the serum, but it was dark by the time he got to Ungoliq. But with the news of the worsening epidemic, Ivanov had shared he had decided not to stop and once again set out to brave the storm across the 20 miles of exposed open ice of the Norton Sound. The temperature was estimated at negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit, but the wind chill with the gale force winds was negative 85 degrees Fahrenheit. Togo led the team in a straight line through the dark, and they arrived at the roadhouse in Isaac's Point on the other side at 8 p.m. In one day, they traveled 84 miles, averaging 8 miles an hour. The team rested and departed at 2 a.m. into the powerful storm. During the night, the temperature dropped to negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and the wind increased to storm force, at least 65 miles an hour. While they slept, the storm had blown all the sea that Seppel had just crossed out to sea. There
So
was still some ice.
the ice that they had crossed got, like, literally just crossed, and got blown out to sea.
Yeah.
And so, like, if they had been, like, a day late, they wouldn't have had a way to cross, basically.
Yeah.
Right?
It
Okay.
would have taken them longer to go around because,
Yeah.
like, the shortcut was across the ice, but it would have taken, like, another day or two to go around all of that.
Yeah.
There was still some ice close to shore for the next part of the journey along the coast, but it was rough and starting to break up too. They stuck close to the shore, and Togo picked his way carefully until they were back on solid ground. This part of the movie is like gives me anxiety.
Yeah.
I hold my breath through this scene every time. The next part, or excuse me, the next, again, excuse me. Next, they had to cross Little McKinley Mountain, which is 1,200 feet in elevation. Another of the toughest parts of the trail because of the many ups and downs of the ridges. The total elevation climbed in that section of over 8 miles is 5,000 feet. After descending to the next roadhouse in Golovin, Sepala passed the serum to Charlie Olson on February 1st at 3 p.m. On February 1st, the number of cases in Nome rose to 28. The serum en route was sufficient to treat 30 people. Oh, okay. So I did math wrong. Apparently, it was enough for 30 people. I
Oh,
don't know.
I don't know about that though. It doesn't seem like it was.
I know.
Yeah.
I gotta do some more cross-referencing here because the math ain't mathin'.
The math ain't.
But apparently it was enough to treat 30 people. With the
All
powerful
right.
blizzard raging and winds of 80 miles an hour, Welch ordered a stop to the relay until the storm passed, reasoning that a delay was better than the risk of losing it all. Messages were left at Solomon and Point Safety before the lines went dead. Olson was blown off the trail and suffered severe frostbite in his hands while putting blankets on his dogs. The wind chill was negative 70 degrees Fahrenheit. He arrived at Bluff on February 1st at 7 p.m. in poor condition. Gunnar Kassen waited until 10 p.m. for the storm to break, but it only got worse and the drifts would soon block the trail, so he departed into a headwind. Gunnar Kassen traveled through the night, through drifts and river overflow with the 600-foot Topkok Mountain. Balto led the team through visibility so poor that Kassen could not always see the dogs harnessed close to the sled. He was 2 miles past Solomon before he realized it and kept going. The winds after Solomon were so severe that his sled flipped over and he almost lost the cylinder containing the serum
Oh
when it fell
shit.
off and became buried in the snow. He also suffered frostbite when he had to use his bare hands to feel the cylinder. Kassen reached Point Safety ahead of schedule on February 2nd at 3 a.m. Kassen pressed on with the remaining 25 miles to Nome, reaching Front Street at 5:30 a.m. Not a single ampule was broken, and the toxin was thawed and ready by noon. Together, the teams that covered the 674 miles in 127 and a half hours which was considered a world record done in extreme sub-zero temperatures and near blizzard conditions and hurricane force winds. And a number of dogs died during the trip. But that is the story of the Serum Run and how all of these dogs helped to save a small town in Alaska. And so the hero of the story is Togo, and I'm going to die on this hill, honestly. And so now I'm going to get into Togo as a dog and how he is a fantastic dog.
I redid the math, and like they would have to have twice the amount.
I'm like kind of confused on like the numbers there. So I don't know.
Maybe one of those numbers you got was inaccurate, because even with like the least conservative, like say if 125,000 saved six people, like to save 30 people, you would need 625,000.
Yeah. Could have been a typo or something somewhere. I mean, I looked at a couple of websites and I don't know. I kind of mushed everything together. So,
I mean, I'm not a doctor. So,
I'm not a doctor either. I'm going with what I read. Yeah. But anyway, the point being, there was enough serum to help a small amount of people, not enough for the whole town, but you know, enough to put a Band-Aid over it. But anyway, getting into Togo as a dog, because he's great. As a puppy, Togo developed a painful throat disorder that caused Sepala to lose interest in him. And eventually Sepala gave Togo up for adoption. And just backtrack a little bit. Leonard Sepala bred his sled dogs.
Okay.
So he had like this whole like farmland of where he had all of these kennels and stuff. And so Togo was born and he ended up getting this throat disorder and he was like, he's not going to be a good sled dog. I'll give him up for adoption. Togo refused to be parted from the Sepala family and his team and later escaped his adoptee's home by jumping through a window. This devotion to the team impressed Sepala, so he did not try to give him away again. However, Togo continued to cause trouble by breaking out of the kennel when Sepala took the team out on runs. He would attack the lead dogs of oncoming teams as if to clear the way for his master. However, one day, he attacked a much stockier Malamute. How do you say that?
Malamute.
It looks like a husky. It's just bigger.
They're like big, fluffy huskies.
Yeah. So Togo attacked that kind of lead dog one day and was mauled and severely injured.
Oh, jeez. Great, Togo. So Togo probably would have been put down in today's world.
Yeah, he fuck around and find out. So that would eventually prove to be a valuable early experience, though, because as it was difficult to teach a lead dog to keep a wide berth of oncoming teams, that attack kind of put Togo in his place and was like, okay,
I see. It's like, the Malamute mauled Togo.
Yeah. Because Togo would frequently kind of like go after the oncoming teams, like get the fuck out of the way. Like, and then one day one dog did not have a good time with that.
Yeah.
So he learned his lesson pretty quick. When Togo was 8 months old, he proved his worth as a sled dog. Sepala had been hired by a client to transport him quickly to a newly discovered gold claim, which would be an overnight round trip for the team. Unable to spare extra time dealing with the young Togo's antics, Sepala tethered him inside the kennel with instructions to not let him free until him and his team were well and gone, because he frequently got out because he wanted to join the team. A short while later, after Sepala had left, Togo broke free of the tether and jumped the kennel fence, getting his paw caught in the process. A kennel handler noticed and cut the dog down from the fencing, but before he could grab him, Togo took off to follow the team's trail. He followed them through the nightfall and slept unnoticed near the cabin where Sepala was spending the night. The next day, Sepala spotted him far off in the distance and understood why his dogs had been so keyed up. But I guess, like, you know, he was sleeping outside. All the dogs inside were like, what's going on out there? And Togo's just like, I'm here with my fans. Like,
that's so funny. Because he's just like, I'm going to do my job. Damn it.
Yeah. He's like, you cannot keep me from this. I want to play with you guys. Yeah. So Togo continued to make Sepala's work difficult on the return trip to the kennel, trying to play with the work dogs and leading them in chase charges against reindeer, as he puts it. Pulling them off the trail, Seppala had no clue but to put him in a harness to control him, and was surprised that Togo instantly settled down. Just, kind of straitjacketed him, apparently.
Well, I was like, thank you. This is what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Hustle culture, baby.
Yeah.
Gotta put in that work.
It's so funny. Like the way that the Disney Plus movie depicts him as a puppy is like the most hilarious thing. As the run wore on, Seppala kept moving Togo up the line until at the end of the day, he was sharing the lead position with a lead dog named Rusky. Togo had logged 75 miles on his first day in the harness, which was unheard of for an inexperienced young sled dog, especially a puppy. Seppala called him an infant prodigy and later added that I had found a natural born leader, something I had tried for years to breed. And then there's a picture of a clip from the movie of Seppala bringing Togo back to the kennels after he tried to get out and run with
Yeah.
them.
And I was like, it's interesting that they chose, oh, what's his name? Willem Dafoe for the like actor. And I was looking at pictures. He looks a lot like Seppala.
Yeah, he
Like
looks very similar.
it
It's a
did a
good
good
choice.
job. Yeah.
Yeah. Togo began training and after a few years filled the lead dog position nearly full time, often running in single lead without a partner. His prowess as a leader consisted of many impressive feats of intelligence and endurance documented by writers and historians through accounts by Seppala himself. One such occasion was during the crossing of the Norton Sound in a deadly northeast gale, which we had just been talking about. Seppala had ordered Togo to turn in order to avoid a crack forming in the ice, and immediately after doing so, Togo abruptly stopped and somersaulted backwards into the rest of the team without being commanded to stop moving. When Seppala arrived at the front of the team to scold the dog, he discovered that Togo had bailed not on the trail, but to avoid an open growing water channel less than 6 feet from the team, which was not visible from the sled. Because remember, they're in these gale force winds and it's fucking cold out and they can't see anything.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was stated in the Serum Run story that he carefully chose his path when they were running across Norton Sound. And that's the prime example is like he was able to see this crack forming and was like straight up just broke the whole, like just went backwards,
Yeah.
just like somersaulted
Like,
backwards and be like, no, we
nope.
can't do that. Yeah. Having saved all of them from kneeling dr nearly drowning in the freezing water. Another impressive feat was during the same trip across the sound. When arriving at the shore of the Bering Sea, the ice floe that the team was on top of was too far from land for them to cross or Seppala to jump over. So he hitched Togo in single lead with an anchor in the ice and tossed him across to pull the ice closer to shore. Togo understood and dug in. However, the line snapped, suddenly leaving Seppala and the team stranded. Without guidance or prompting, Togo leapt into the water, took the broken line in his mouth, and spun to wrap it around his shoulders, twice fashioning a makeshift harness, and pulled the ice floe to shore with his team with it.
That's a
So,
smart freaking dog.
yeah, no, that's why I'm saying like Togo is honestly like the main character. Like it's not Balto. Like all the shit that Togo went through to get that serum across, like he's being chucked up onto like a like another piece of land to try to pull
Yeah.
an ice floe closer, and then he falls in the water, and then he gets the line and wraps it around himself and still pulls him. Like, that's
Right.
smart. Like, it's a good dog.
Marzi could never
Waylon would,
because
yeah, no, Waylon
water
would
is a no-no, so she'd be like, you're fucked. Sorry.
Yeah.
And then
Waylon.
also, she's afraid of like walking through doors. So,
Yeah.
you know.
I just imagine Waylon, like in that scenario, if I were to chuck him up there, he'd be like, Mom, what the fuck? Like,
Fuck you, Mom.
what do I do now? He'd be so scared. Oh my God, that poor puppy dog face when he's so scared. I can't stand
I
it.
know.
So Togo went on to become one of Seppala's most treasured dogs, a close and mutually beneficial relationship that would continue to the end of Togo's life. At the time of the historic serum run, he was 12 years old and had been a lead dog for 7 years. So he was pretty old, like when he
Yeah.
went through all of that. And then we get into the serum run, which we just talked about. But just to recap a little bit, in 1925, in response to the epidemic, the first batch of more than 300,000 units of the diphtheria serum was delivered by train from Anchorage to Nenana, Alaska, where it was picked up by the first of 20 mushers and more than 100 dogs who relayed the serum a total of 674 miles to Nome. Togo and Seplo ran 170 miles east from Nome to just outside Shakotuk, where they met the serum relay coming the other way on January 31st. After the handoff, they returned another 91 miles to Golovin, where they passed the serum to Charlie Olson's team, having run over 261 miles across some of the most dangerous and treacherous parts of the run in total. So in total, Seppala's team traveled 260 miles from Nome in 3 days.
Dang.
The temperature was estimated at negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit, and the gale force winds causing a wind chill of negative 85 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
The return trip crossed the exposed open ice of the Norton Sound. The night and a ground blizzard prevented Seppala from being able to see the path, but Togo navigated to the roadhouse at Isaac's Point on the shore by 8 p.m., preventing certain death to his team. After traveling 84 miles in 1 day, the team slept for 6 hours before continuing at 2 a.m. Before the night and the temperature dropped to negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit and the wind increased to 65 miles an hour, the team ran across the ice, which was breaking up while following the shoreline. They returned to shore to cross Little McKinley Mountain, climbing 5,000 feet. After descending to the next roadhouse in Golovin, Seppala passed the serum to Charlie Olson, who in turn passed it to Gunnar Kassen and Balto. By the time Togo led his team over 261 miles during the serum run to deliver diphtheria antitoxin, he was 12 years old, despite covering a far greater distance than any other lead dogs on the run. Over some of the most dangerous parts of the trail, his role was left out of contemporary news of the event at the time in favor of the lead dog for the last leg of the relay, who was Balto, whom Seppala also owned and had bred. Though Balto received the credit for saving the town, to those who know more than the Disney story, Balto is considered the backup dog. Balto ran 55 miles, while Togo's leg of the journey was the longest and most dangerous. And again, I will die on this fucking hill. There's a photo with Seppala and his dogs after the run, and Togo is on the far left, still looking super stoked, tongue out, happy, like, you know, just excited.
He's totally jazzed. He's like, yeah. What are we talking? I could have run it all the way to Nome if you'd wanted me to.
Yeah.
I could have been Balto.
Yeah, he probably could have, honestly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just have him bold here. Let me repeat. Balto ran 55 miles. Togo ran over 261 miles. Togo also ran through the most dangerous part of the journey, and he was 12. Like, again. Yeah, I will spend the rest of my life correcting anyone who tries to talk to me about Balto. I'm like, no, don't tell me. No. So Togo got some recognition, though. In October of 1926, Seppala, Togo, and the team of dogs went on a tour from Seattle, Washington to California. Seppala and Togo drew large crowds at the stadium and the department stores and even appeared in a Lucky Strike cigarette campaign. In New York City.
Lucky Strike cigarettes.
Right. In New York City, Seppala drove his team from the steps of City Hall along Fifth Avenue and made a pass through Central Park. The team appeared multiple times at Madison Square Garden, which was being managed by Tom Rickard, formerly of Nome, and where on December 30th, Togo was awarded a gold medal by Roald Amundsen.
Who?
Togo was awarded a gold medal by Roald Amundsen.
Who, if anybody is not remembering, is the, when we talked about the South Pole race, he's the one who made it to the South Pole and back. He was the first group of people to go to the South Pole.
In New England, they competed in several dog sled races against local Chinooks of Arthur Walden and won by huge margins. The success of Seppala's races and the celebrity afforded to the dogs and the mushers by the serum run allowed Seppala to begin a Siberian dog kennel in partnership with Elizabeth M. Ricker in Poland Spring, Maine. Togo was left to live at the Ricker kennel to enjoy a life of luxury in his retirement from sled work and was bred over the next several years, laying down the foundation for the modern Siberian sled dog breeds known as the Seppala Siberian Sled Dog and the Siberian Husky. In 1928, Elizabeth M. Ricker of Poland Spring, Maine, wrote and published the book Togo's Fireside Reflections. Seppala inked Togo's paw and helped Togo sign some of the books.
Oh, that's cute.
That's cute, right? After several years of retirement at the Ricker Kennel in Poland Spring, Togo was euthanized by Seppala on December 5th, 1929, at 16 years old because of joint pain and partial blindness. The headline in the New York Sun-Times the next day was, quote, Dog Hero Rides to His Death, end quote. And he was eulogized in many other papers. After his death, Seppala had him custom mounted. The mounted skin was on display at the Shelbourne Museum in Shelbourne, Vermont. Alaskan students started a letter campaign to return Togo to Alaska. Today, the mountain's skin is on display in a glass case at the Iditarod
I
Trail.
did. I did a
I did a
rod.
rod. I did a rod. God damn it. Today, the mountain skin is on display in a glass case at the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race Headquarters Museum in Wasilla, Alaska. While the Peabody Museum of Natural History at Yale University has his skeleton in their collection.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bones versus skin.
I feel like I don't know because I'm a bone girl. I like bones. I have all kinds of skulls and stuff, but I'd rather see like the mount, I guess,
I
because it's like
know.
the real thought. I don't know. It is
Yeah.
kind of weird, but I'm not against stuffing animals to like resemble their likeness, but
Yeah.
it is a little weird.
The National Park Service notes that in 1960, Seppala said, quote, "I never had a better dog than Togo. His stamina, loyalty, and intelligence could not be improved upon. Togo was the best dog that ever traveled the Alaska Trail." Togo's reputation earned him enduring fame, but only in 1997 got for the first time a statue, although sitting alongside Balto's statue at the Cleveland Metro Park Zoo. In 2001, he finally got an individual statue, but of a minor size initially at New York City's Lower East Side and later moved to Seward Park. The popular fictional teen sleuth Nancy Drew named a stray terrier after him in the 1937 novel The Whispering Statue. The dog appears in most of Nancy Drew novels. In 2011, Time magazine named Togo the most heroic animal of all time. Quote, "The dog that often gets credit for eventually saving the town is Balto, but he just happened to run the last 55-mile leg in the race. The sled dog who did the lion's share of the work was Togo. His journey, fraught with whiteout storms, was the longest by 200 miles and included a traverse across perilous Norton Sound, where he saved his team and driver in a courageous swim through ice floes," end quote. On September 17, 2022, a bronze statue of Togo was unveiled in Poland Springs, Maine, where Togo spent his last years as a stud dog. Maine musher Jonathan Hayes of the current Poland Springs Seppala Kennels embarked on a 285-mile expedition in previous year with his team of direct descendants of Togo in order to raise funds for the statue, with a documentary to raise awareness for the project. The statue was designed by Maine artist David Smoos, and stands outside the historic Maine State Building on the resort campus. And then that is a photo of Togo mounted below that.
His mount looks a lot better than Balto's because I've been looking up pictures
Oh,
and
yeah.
Balto's. You know, there's like a website or like a, I don't know if it's an Instagram account or something, and they just have like, it's dedicated to bad taxidermy.
Oh.
I feel like
Oh
Balto's mount should be on that page because it's
no.
not great.
Yeah, I'll have to look
Yeah.
it up. But there are film adaptions of Togo too. So, like we said, there is a film adaptation about Togo's efforts that was produced by Walt Disney Pictures and released on December 20th, 2019 on Disney Plus. William Dafoe stars in the film as Leonard Seppala, the owner of Togo. Principal production on the film ran from September 24th, 2018 to February 2019 in Calgary. Togo was portrayed by a dog actor whose name is Diesel, who is a direct descendant of Togo's 14 generations back.
Cool.
So, fun fact. There's also another film called The Great Alaskan Race from P12 Films that also depicts the heroics of both team and does of the both teams and does show both Balto and Togo. In this depiction, Balto is represented by a large black and white Alaskan Malamute, but focuses primarily on Seppala. The film is accurate to an extent, and more so than some other depictions, but still deviates from reality and did not include a few major events. However, like the Disney film, it does focus on both Togo and Balto rather than Balto alone, though it did incorrectly give credit to both teams jointly for the last 50-mile stretch.
So now
That's the
I got homework. I gotta go watch that movie.
Yeah, go watch Togo. It will bring tears to your eyes.
All right, you watch Bluey and cry,
Yeah.
and then I'll watch Togo and cry.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's the story of the Serum Run and Togo the dog, who will always be in my heart, and I will die on the hill of Togo, proving everybody wrong that Balto is not as important. So
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
I mean,
my
I knew Togo was like the actual dog that did a lot of the work, but I do appreciate, although like, yes, he crossed the most dangerous section, and the longest section. I mean, that's a long trail, and there were a lot of dog teams involved and
Yeah.
there. Like, You know what I mean? So it's good that we talk about all of them. And I always thought that maybe I just got confused, but I always thought that the Iditarod Trail was like commemorative of the Serum Run. But
Oh,
looking
yeah,
at
I don't know.
the maps, I'm like, no, the Iditarod is like pretty much an entirely separate trail for the most part.
Yeah.
Except like the part that Togo ran is part of the Iditarod. But like the trail from like that town near Fairbanks, Nima or whatever.
Nenana.
Yeah. Like that part's not part of the Iditarod. So it's like they had to like make a new trail instead of, you know. So
Yeah.
I'm learning new things.
Yeah, no, it's I don't know. I really enjoy that story. It's just like a great story of like how people come together to try to save a community and like everybody. I don't know. I just think it was like back then that was like that generation though. They're like, I feel responsible, I'm willing and able, like I'm gonna do it. Like I have the resources, I have the capabilities and I'm smart, like I've done some, I'm sure most of those mushers, like none of the mushers died, just some of the dogs died. And like those dogs were inexperienced dogs, but maybe that's like all that they had because they like, were breeding them at different times of the year or something. I have no idea how that works, but and it's sad, but it's like, they were trying to save a community from a disease outbreak.
And
So
children too, you
yeah, and
know,
kids, like
like, yeah, because the kids were the ones that got it like the most, right? It
Oh, that's what
seems.
it seemed like when I was reading about it. It was always some kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I do think there are some like modern examples of this kind of like selflessness. Like we talked a lot about Katrina, and like, you know, some of the heroic stuff that they were doing, like Coast Guard rescue guys going out again and again and again, not getting any sleep, or like locals, like literally rescuing people on their own boats and stuff. So definitely some examples, but it's interesting with the whole Togo versus Balto thing. Like media played such a big role too, because like when we were kids, we were, oh, it's Balto, it's Balto, because that Disney
Yeah.
movie came out. And it's crazy that like even then it was Balto. You
Yeah.
know, even when they had the like information of like, yes, this is what happened, like, you know,
They still
that,
wanted to pick Balto.
yeah.
And like what's funny too is I don't know how true this is, but this is what's at the end in the movie in Togo. When the lead musher, so Kassin, comes across into town, there's a reporter that asks him the like for the lead dog's name, and he goes, oh, that's Fox or something. And the reporter was like, oh, that's not a catchy name enough. And he's like, ah, that one's Balto. And so then like it kind of gives the impression that maybe Balto wasn't even the lead dog. He just kind of like picked a different dog for the media because it sounded better, so I'm also curious like
Interesting.
how accurate that is, but I yeah, because the reporter was like, Fox, that's not a catchy enough name for a sled dog, like
But why not? Why not Fox?
I don't know,
Who gives a
but
shit?
yeah, that's in the ending of Togo in the movie on Disney Plus too.
Interesting.
Yeah,
Okay.
it's
I
funny how the
have to watch
media,
it.
yeah, I mean to this day, I mean we could go on a whole rant about media stuff,
We
but
could.
it's the media has always been like an issue. You know what I mean? They've always wanted to put the best thing out there to their liking. So, and depending on what media you consume, that's what you're going to start believing is reality. And I just hope that people have good enough brains to know to check their sources.
They
And
don't.
I know that they don't, but that's just one thing I hope people can learn to do. Just read different sources and fact check and just like put two and two together in your brain. Like, oh, yeah. Anyway.
No. But it's a double-edged sword, because if we didn't have media, then we'd be fed everything from like the government. And so it's like we
I
need
know.
journalists, but like they can bias everything, like depending on like the network they work for. So it's, you
Yeah.
know, without going down a rabbit hole, it's a double-edged
Yeah,
sword for
that's
sure.
true.
But we need media. We need like independent people investigating this stuff. Otherwise, like it'll get covered up. you know? So, double-edged sword. So, anyway, do you want to do your sources?
Oh yeah, shit. My sources are NPS.gov, which is for the Togo story, obviously. And then we did Wikipedia for Togo and then also Wikipedia for the Serum Run to Nome.
Okay. So I have, speaking of animals, I have a conservation corner,
Woo!
and I actually am really enjoying doing these. Like when I have my week off, I'm like, what animal am I gonna
Yeah,
do?
that's awesome.
So I like put this together in like an hour, but I decided to do something that we both know a decent amount about, which is salmon, which
Oh,
is
salmon.
a big, huge, probably the most important fishery in Alaska, and probably one of the most important sources of like nutrients to a majority of ecosystems in Alaska.
Yeah.
So I chose to do sockeye salmon in particular. There's like five different species of salmon in Alaska, but I always think sockeye salmon are the most interesting because they like when they're in their like breeding mating
They're
colors,
red.
they
Yes.
and the males look like straight up monsters.
They do. It's pretty impressive.
So they've got these like hooked like jaws and like these huge humps
It's
and
super. I think it's wild how animals can change that
I
drastically for
know.
breeding. Like,
Yeah.
it just blows my mind.
Like they're literally changing their entire body shape to fuck.
Yeah, they go from like this silvery, streamlined kind of fish to like
Yeah.
a bright red humpback, like scary
Freak.
jaw looking freaky fish. Yeah.
Like a male breeding sockeye salmon could rival some deep sea fish for like ugliness.
Yes. Yes. But I'm interested in this because I was reading a few things recently about the salmon fishery, and I'm going to be curious if you touch on some of those things I was reading about. So I'm listening.
Okay. Yeah, so it's one of the most iconic salmon species because of that coloration. I should have looked up this. I'm so bad at pronouncing scientific names, which is funny because I'm a fucking scientist.
Yeah, it's fine. Me too.
Corynchus nerka.
Nerka. Know how to do that
And the name, the sockeye, is a result of a poor attempt to translate the word sake from the Salish language, and that
one.
sake means red fish.
Oh. Oh,
Yeah.
okay.
And Salish people are like around like British Columbia, like Washington, like Olympic Peninsula kind of
Okay.
area. Yeah.
Can I click on this video of how to pronounce the scientific name real quick?
Yeah, please do.
Oncorhynchus. Oncorhynchus.
Oncorhynchus.
Yeah. There you go.
Oncorhynchus nerka. Thank
Yeah.
you.
You're
I
welcome.
always am like, I'll figure it out. And then I try to figure it out and I'm like,
I can't figure this out. Fair.
They're the third most prevalent salmon species in the Pacific. Like I said, they've got that iconic spawning look in adults, and the males are the ones that develop the hump and the hook jaw, but the females pretty much stay the same shape. They just have the green head and the red body, like the males do. In their oceanic stage, they are much less recognizable, with silver iridescent flanks, a white belly, and a metallic green blue top, and are called bluebacks at this stage. And they have very like it's more of a trout like look. Sockeye are third in terms of average weight,
Oh.
weighing 1.5 to 3.5 kilograms and 80 centimeters in length. So they aren't the biggest of the salmon species, but they are the premium Pacific salmon in international marketplaces. Like when I go to a store at HEB down here in Texas, the two salmon varieties that are most often available are Atlantic salmon because they're farmed and those are usually cheaper, and then sockeye, which are usually more expensive.
Yeah.
but I don't, we don't get any other kinds down here, which is interesting.
That is interesting.
So, sockeye sells more per pound than all other Pacific salmon species, but Chinook salmon. The meat is tinted orange due to the consumption of red krill during the time at sea and has a highly desirable flavor. So, like a flamingo, their skin, or not their skin, but their meat gets tinted pink because they
Yes.
eat krill. It's also one of the best studied species in all of Alaska. It ranges across the North Pacific Ocean, the Bering Sea, up to like the most southern parts of the Arctic Ocean. So it's got a pretty big oceanic range.
Yeah.
And the freshwater spawning ranges from the Pacific Northwest, so like Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, up the coast towards Alaska and over into Russia, including the Aleutian Islands in Alaska as well. There is even some limited spawning distribution into the Arctic Ocean of Alaska and the Seward Peninsula, which includes Nome. But the areas they traveled over are within the breeding range of this fish. So ocean or non-spawning ranges from the northern Pacific Ocean, from the Pacific Northwest and northern Japan, up north to the Sea of Okhotsk. I don't know how to say that. Never known how to say that. The Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska up to the Chukchi Sea and the Arctic Ocean. So it not only covers like North America, but also like Russian Siberia is this
Gotcha.
fish's reach.
Well, yeah, because Alaska is so close to Russia.
Yeah, they're like right
Yeah,
there.
they're right there. Yeah, it's easy to get over there.
Yeah. So I'm talking a lot about like ocean sage, freshwater sage, breeding sage. They are anadromous, meaning they live in the ocean for most of their life and then spawn in rivers and other freshwater
Yeah.
areas. So they feed in the ocean for about 1 to 4 years prior to spawning. Here they feed on fish, squid, small crustaceans like krill and travel thousands of miles during this time across the ocean, basically drifting in the currents of ocean gyres up here. Adult fish return to rivers to spawn in June and July, in freshwater drainages that contain one or more lakes. And they're unique in that they are one of the few salmons that's kind of reliant on lakes. And they return to the same freshwater systems from which they hatched. So they spawn in lakes, on beaches or over river gravel. They may spend anywhere from a few weeks to 3 years in freshwater, and this depends on their specific population. They deposit 2,000 to 5,000 eggs each into one or more reds, which are holes or trenches that the female digs with her tail over several days. And then the males deposit the sperm over the eggs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Both males and females, adults, die within a few weeks of spawning. Here's my favorite fun fact about salmon. They are considered almost zombies during spawning runs as their primary goal is reproduction. They do not eat at this time. And by the end of spawning, their bodies are actively decaying.
Yeah, they
So,
are. I
yeah,
seen it.
it's gross.
Yeah.
It's really
No,
creepy.
so when Sarah and I went to Alaska with some friends, it was in September. So that's like the end of the salmon run. And like we still saw salmon in the streams, but they were like they had like the lesions on them and
Yeah.
stuff like that. Like they definitely were actively decaying. I
They're
was like, this is
literally.
cool, but then also like they're dying. So it's
Yes,
not
yes.
that cool.
So the eggs hatch during the winter, and the young alevins, which are what they call like the very, very early larval stage, remain in the gravel, living off their yolk sacs until they emerge in spring as fry. When spawned in lakes, juveniles can spend 1 to 3 years in freshwater, feeding on zooplankton before migrating to the ocean as smolts. But in systems without lakes, juveniles migrate soon after emerging from the gravel. So it just depends Because like if you show up, if you like emerge into a lake, you're like, oh, this ecosystem has plenty to feed me. So I don't
Yeah.
necessarily need to leave right now. Many populations have unique life cycles, including a resident form of sockeye that spends its entire life in fresh water, which is unusual for salmon. These sockeye are called kokanee, and you can find them
Nice.
in a bunch of different places in their range. Like I said, they're more dependent on lakes than any other species. Lake sockeye are more sporadic, and they require suitable glacial lake landscapes and are more often found on the Kamchatka Peninsula in Puget Sound and Columbia River Basin. Juveniles rear extensively in lakes, and adults spawn on lake shores, which makes them more vulnerable to localized threats.
Gotcha.
So, talks a lot about them, but I think people underestimate their ecological importance in this region.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. Like the salmon feed the bears. And if there's no salmon, then there's no bears. And the bears also have an impact of the environment too. And then the salmon are also feeding millions of people. And I don't know, just keeping everything in balance out there the way that they do things. But tell us more, because I don't know too much about salmon.
There's another step to that I think a lot of people don't realize. So they're considered keystone species to the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, as the salmon runs provide super important nutrients and protein that enter the environment in a variety of ways. So carcasses and eggs are consumed by a variety of predators, including grizzly bears and some populations of grizzly bears, such as Kodiak bears, wolves, scavenging birds, and other predators. In some cases, the diets of coastal wolves, which is like a subpopulation of like gray wolves or timber wolves, can be 50% salmon during these runs. And coastal wolves and bear subpopulations have co-evolved with salmon over millennia. So this is like
Wow.
required for their existence.
Yeah.
The amount of salmon in streams has been shown to correlate directly with bird diversity and surrounding ecosystems as well. So they create these little like eco hotspots basically when the runs are happening. The oceanic and coastal sages of salmon are also important, specifically for marine mammals and some killer whale populations, specifically this group called the southern resident killer whales, almost exclusively feed on oceanic salmon.
Oh, wow.
So that's another big predatory species that would not exist without salmon, or at least that
Yeah.
population wouldn't. Oceanic salmon can also decrease coastal explosions of insects because insects can be primary prey of salmon. So they're pest control.
Oh, wow.
Population density of bears can be 20 times greater in coastal areas where salmon are abundant. Without salmon as a food source, coastal populations of bears would be severely affected. And then
Yeah.
this last one, which is probably the most significant to me, is the Pacific Northwest and Alaskan rivers are almost entirely dependent on the carcasses of salmon to provide organic matter and nutrients into these otherwise very pristine and cold water rivers. There's
Wow.
not a lot of nutrient runoff. There's not a lot of runoff, period, in the same way that we see out here in the southeast. There's so much, too many nutrients in our
Yeah.
rivers. But up there, it's not. These nutrients are transferred to all levels of the food chain. In addition, these nutrients can even impact trees nearby salmon run rivers and like improve tree growth, like near the rivers, because there's so many nutrients going into the soil.
That's crazy.
So it's not only the predators, it's everything from the base up,
Yeah.
which is neat.
So, I'm sorry if I missed it. Did you talk about the dams at all?
I'm gonna talk about the
Okay.
dams.
Okay, that was my question, 'cause that's what I've been reading about recently, 'cause I saw it on one oops, I saw it on one of my friends' Instagram stories, 'cause she's like a freelancer for all of these like fishing industry media. And so I saw her post a link on her story about signing some petition for like the dams in Alaska in
Yeah.
relation to the salmon fishery. And ever since I saw her post that, I was like, I need to read more about this because I had no idea that that was happening. So I'll let you take it away though.
So if we're talking about that, we'll talk about the cultural importance as well. Obviously everybody likes salmon, but people have been fishing for and utilizing salmon in Alaska for at least 12,000 years.
Oh, wow.
12,000 years.
It's a long time.
The industrialization of salmon fisheries began in the late 1800s, and Alaska became a state in 1959. So our exploitation of this fishery really hasn't started until like the last two centuries. But salmon continue to play key roles in health and well-being of Alaska and the Pacific Northwest's indigenous cultures. New fishing practices and colonization have greatly impacted the Alaskan indigenous and salmon connection, including things like resource extraction, a lack of resource access for indigenous people, and resource management by the state, that favors privatized fishing, commercial fishing. One of the biggest issues is the inequities of the salmon system, and it's very evident of the colonialism that has undergone in this region. So after industrialization, the fisheries have become more privatized, which benefits urban or like non-Alaskans who have the money to fund these big boats. And subsistence fishing has become more criminalized. So lots of rural local fishing rights have been lost, which is something that these people have been doing literally for thousands of years.
Oh, wow.
The Kodiak Archipelago, Adutik, and Sujapeg communities have seen an 84% decline in the number of young commercial salmon fishermen from their groups. And it's because it's expensive to get started and the rights just aren't there. So many Alaskan indigenous worldviews consider salmon sentient, non-human relations that give themselves to fishermen and demand reciprocal respect. So respect includes following appropriate practices and care for salmon populations and salmon themselves when you harvest them. So
Yeah.
it is like key to a lot of cultural groups there, which makes commercial fishing very much at odds with how they've interacted with the land for thousands of years.
Yeah, it seems like it. And then, like, if they're getting their quote unquote rights taken away to fish them, like, that's fucked up.
Yeah. The status of sockeye right now, and I will say, and this is considering what we just talked about, kind of crazy to say, but salmon are one of the most sustainable fisheries in the world, because we're literally able to count them as they come in. And you can't do that with a lot of other fisheries. So the status of sockeye status varies significantly region by region, because there's a lot of individual populations. So global status of the species has been given the ranking of least concerned by IUCN in 2008 and 2011, but many like local stocks are not faring well or have an uncertain status. In 2008, scientists classified 31% of sockeye stocks, i.e., localized populations, as threatened by IUCN criteria, and 32% as data deficient, meaning they didn't have enough data to determine their status. So we don't know. As of 2023, two lower 48, so contiguous US populations of sockeye salmon have been listed as endangered. And a lot of those are on the Columbia River Basin. And one of the major threats to sockeye salmon are dams, and there are quite a lot of dams in the Columbia River Station, River Basin. And basically, what this does is prevent the fish from moving into their normal spawning grounds, so you lose that subpopulation of fish.
And then wouldn't it also remove like all the nutrients that you talked about too from reaching the rest of those ecosystems? So,
Yeah. So they either have to adapt to it and spawn at lower parts of the river where it's not dammed, or they don't reproduce.
Yeah.
And yeah, those upper reaches don't get the nutrients. And so then that has a big snowball effect on everything.
Yeah, it's bad.
So that's
But
one big issue.
you know what I say though? Adapt or die. I remember one time my brother and I were like doing something and he was like, I don't know, like plans changed. And I was like, adapt or die, bro. Come on, let's go. Like,
I mean, that's true, but it's like,
it's sad. It shouldn't
we're
be that
putting in
way.
dams at such a fast rate that it's like
I
they
know.
cannot adapt. This would not happen naturally.
It makes me wonder too, like what is like the study that's done before they put the dams in? You know what I mean? Like, are they really looking into the impact on the environment, or are they really just looking into like the impact from like the hydrology aspect of things? So.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stakeholders involved when they make these decisions, and I typically they'll hire environmental and mitigation groups to like do the study, so it's like an outside consultant often. But unless there is a direct threat and the species is very endangered, it's unlikely that it'll prevent a big project such as this. And
Gotcha.
sockeye are
They don't
listed
have
as
enough
least
data.
concern.
Yeah, and some of them they don't have data for, right? Some species of salmon is what you said. Yeah. Well,
And
that's bummer.
money
Yeah.
talks. So, other big obvious ones are overfishing, which I think in this case, salmon are a little bit better managed than other species, again, because we can literally count them as they come into the rivers, as opposed to like an oceanic species where they're out there somewhere. Like you can't count them officially. And then obviously climate change for them is huge because these rivers that they're living in are getting warmer, and soon some rivers may not be habitable for salmon at all because they're a cold water species.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is an issue for trout even more so because they can't like use the ocean to go up into different rivers. They're just
Yeah.
stuck in that river, right?
Gosh, I didn't even think about that, but that's true.
Specific projects too. I'm sure a lot of people have heard maybe of the Pebble Mine project in Alaska.
I was just reading that, actually.
So it's located at the headwaters of the Dushagak and Kivikchak rivers in the Bristol Bay region, which is one of the most productive salmon ecosystems on Earth. And it is the largest sockeye run. If constructed, Pebble Mine would be the world's second largest copper, gold, and molybdenum mine, and would include the world's largest dam to hold back the toxic tailings
Oh my
from the
God.
mining. So basically, the big concern is that there'd be a lot of really bad chemicals and metals, hard metals and stuff in the water that would severely impact salmon production.
Yeah, and it would stay there forever, seems
Forever.
like. Yeah.
And this is a big thing that local groups and fisheries groups, marine biologists, everybody's trying to fight back against because it's just like, why are we doing this?
Yeah,
It's
I'm
gonna
reading.
impact a lot of industry besides like mining's not the only thing going on in that region. There's other very economically important aspects. I mean, fisheries are it's a huge economic importance.
Yeah, I'm reading here on wildsalmoncenter.org that this is a 2 billion a year salmon fishing economy. Yeah.
There's a couple ways that I think would be very useful to support sustainable sockeye salmon fisheries. So you can donate to the Wild Salmon Center, which is developing a report to examine the threats to Bristol Bay's wild salmon fisheries by the Pebble Mine. Pay attention to seafood sustainability surrounding salmon, specifically using the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, which puts out a comprehensive report of all fisheries every couple of months. And it's literally on a little baby card, super simple to read, understand. Basically, what it does is it can tell you what seafood is most sustainable to purchase from your local grocery store and why.
Yeah, and they have a like PDF version on their website too, where like it does it by region. Like I think for us, let me
Yes.
see.
If you live in Oregon, another good way would be to look into ways you can support, signing petitions and preventing more dam building, or,
Yeah.
in your area in Alaska or Washington, if you happen to live in any of those states.
No, I was gonna say if you go to the seafoodwatch.org, go to recommendation, then consumer guides, you can find your type of coast or region
Yeah.
for your guide.
And then the last thing, purchase salmon products from indigenous owned companies
Yes.
if you can, like,
Yes.
to help that aspect of the fishery as well. So, real quick, I'll just do my sources. So I got information from Wild Salmon Center, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, National Geographic, NOAA, and then for more specific stuff, I got information from Pacific Wild, an article by Hannah Bugis, the salmon, a keystone species. And then the State of Alaska Salmon and People got an article about social and cultural dimensions of salmon systems in Alaska. And
Nice.
that's
That's
everything.
that.
All right. So we talked about doggies.
Yep. And we talked about salmon.
Yeah. So let's talk about happy things. Wrap this
Happy
up.
things. Yeah. Happy thing is we got our engagement pictures taken yesterday.
Yeah.
So excited about those. And yeah, that's kind of, I'm happy to be home for a hot minute. And then I fly to Wyoming and
I
then I come
know.
back for another hot minute and then I fly again. But yeah, I'm also happy that all of those fucking events that occurred in July are over because
Yes.
that bout near broke me. So yeah.
Hooray!
Hooray.
So, my happy thing, I guess I have two.
Yeah.
So, I got to go see my really good friend Jenny, who is my maid of honor, or I guess matron of honor, whatever you want to call it, at my wedding. I have not seen her in for freaking ever because COVID, and then we took all our leave for Maui, and then we took all our leave for weddings, and it just hasn't worked out. And we finally were able to go. They have a lake house in the Ozarks in Arkansas, and it was so nice to be able to go up there, kind of escape the heat, and see her and meet the two kids she's had during the
Oh my
pandemic
God.
and otherwise
That's
that I
crazy. Oh my
haven't met.
God.
So that was really nice. And then I'm going to Finland in a week.
Oh yeah, that's
Yeah.
so soon.
Yeah.
That's
So
exciting.
when this episode comes out, I will be in Europe.
Cool.
It's
That's
been a
so
long
cool.
time since I've been overseas, so I'm like, huh, how do we? I have an
How do you do
iPhone
this?
now. Like, can you text people on an iPhone in
Can
Europe? Like,
you?
how do I don't know. I should figure that out.
Huh.
So it's like, technology has advanced so much since the last time
Yeah.
I went, because the last time I went, I had a fucking flip phone. So like, so that's been interesting. But we're going for our really good friend's wedding, surprise, surprise. But also we're like, well, let's just turn this into a vacation because it's a huge destination wedding for us, and we haven't seen them since my wedding. So it'll be nice to see everybody and get to tour around the country again, and Corey for the first time. And my mom's
Oh yeah.
coming, and it's the first time
Oh.
she's been to Finland since like her and my dad were young before
That's
kids.
so awesome.
So it'll be fun. I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
That,
Oh, that'll be great.
yes. So that's our vacation for the year is Finland. Which I know is very random, but it's going to be so nice to get out of the heat because it's going to
Yeah.
be like in the high 60s and 70s there. I'm like,
Oh. A nice fall day.
yeah,
What
exactly.
I'd give.
So, all right. So, where can our listeners find us?
Yeah, our listeners can find us on the internet, because technology has advanced. So, if you guys would like to follow us on social media, we have a Facebook page that I believe is what would you name it? Mother Nature Will Kill You. That's that.
Yes,
And
yes.
then, Our Instagram is Mother Nature Will Kill You Podcast. Our TikTok that I need to get back in the loop with is Mother, or no, it's MNWKY Podcast. And then our website is mothernaturewillkillyoupodcast.com. And then you can listen to us on all streaming platforms. So that's like your Apple Podcasts and your Google Podcasts and also Spotify. And yeah, that's about it.
And if you are a legendary dog musher and or dog who brought life-saving serum to some diseased children in Alaska, we want to hear about it. But
yeah,
if you haven't done that, if you've just, I don't know, been on a dog sled in general, we want to hear about that too. Or if you've had any uncomfy or slightly scary experiences in nature, please send those stories to, we have a page on our website that you can submit those stories to, or you can send it to our Gmail. And then if you want to support the podcast but don't have any money because we live in a post-capitalist hellscape, you can give us a 5-star review on any of our listening platforms and tell the algorithm to make people listen to us and our dumb voices.
Yes, our dumb voices.
I'm not going to pretend like we're not annoying.
No,
we are.
Yeah.
I'm well idiot. Aware of that. But some people are into that, so.
Yeah. Let's just, like, stumble through a story and figure it out together.
Yeah, exactly. And, oh, you have a tangent or an anecdote? Great, let's talk about that for 5 minutes.
Yeah. Let me just go on my soapbox here and preach about a dog that's better than the other dog.
Yes, the important things in society today. Yes. All right, so with that.
Yeah, until next time, stay safe, but most of all,
stay curious, explorers.
Goodbye.
See ya again later.
Yeah, so we'll recap in 2 weeks.
Yeah.